Hi, it's Mickey Dolenz here. You're listening to Inspirato Projecto.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode, riveting episode of Inspirato Projecto Podcast. Today is April 3rd, 2023. So that's interesting. If you take the 2023, if you add the 2 and 2, you got a 4. So in a sense, today is 4-3-4-3, if you think about it. Right now it is 3:36 in the p.m. And as you well know, Nikola Tesla said 3, 6, and 9 are the numbers, the secrets to the universe. So I think that's pretty cool, huh? 12. And the episode you're about to hear is going to be a two-parter here. You cannot contain this guest that you're about to hear in just one episode. You cannot. He's got far too much information, and the time flies when you're listening to him. He's a spout of information. Ideally, I did a good job asking enough questions that will also perhaps reverberate with you as to questions that you might have asked him if you were there in my shoes. This is Martin Schmidt. We had him before on the show. Martin Schmidt helped renovate the Golden State Theater out there in Monterey, California. Yachtly Crew was out there in Monterey, California. And I said, hey, Martin, I'm going to be in town. I'd love to interview you again. He said, absolutely. So this is the first time he actually saw Yachtly Crew play. So that was very exciting. And you're going to be able to listen to him as he takes me for a tour around Golden State Theater. He's going to bring us around to many different areas. And you'll hear us point out those specific areas. So when you find yourself at the Golden State Theater in Monterey, you too can check out these various spots that he's talking about. He knows all the details, all the ins and outs, all the historical references and dominoes that have fallen through the years concerning the Golden State Theater. He is also a very talented sock monkey enthusiast and creator. In fact, Martin, if you're listening to this, I'm sure there is a sock monkey convention out there somewhere that you could take your sock monkeys to and just bedazzle the eyeballs of the spectators there. So in the show notes, I linked in his YouTube channel. You can just look up Sock Monkey Guy and you will come across him. He shows you step by step how he creates these various sock monkeys. It's very exciting. He does such great customized ones. He made one for me too, a Yachtly Crew sock monkey. All right. Also, we have Mickey Dolenz. Thank you very much, Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees, for stopping by and saying hi. Also, Blythe Baines, thanks to her, she's going to be closing out the show. And Pauly Shores, my brother from Yachtly Crew, he has an extraordinary synchronicity to share with you next. And right after he shares his extraordinary synchronicity with you, we will get on with the show with our featured guest, Martin Schmidt. I think you're going to find him very fascinating. Very fascinating. All right. Take care. Thank you so much for listening to Inspirato Projecto.
Hey, Stony Shores. This is your brother, Pauly Shores. Oh, I had to share this with you. But first of all, I just love the outgoing message on your Inspirato Projecto hotline. Inspirato Projecto. Oh, man, that's the best amalgamation of that jingle that I've ever heard. So I just had to pass that on. But the stroke of synchronicity that just happened to me, I had to share with you. So here goes. This is the real reason we're here. So synchronicity that happened to me on the way to our whiskey gig on my birthday, which the first numerical synchronicity has to be established that my birthday is August 13th, 1975. Well, today is August 13th, 2022. So what's happening is my birthday I just mentioned, the 13th of August. I'm listening to your podcast of the Mario Lopez celebrity golf tournament for St. Joseph's Hospital. Beautiful setting. Listening to the podcast, and you're interviewing a Uber driver, as you are, which is a big part of your show that I love. Let me tell you, it's you get some great content with your Uber driver conversations. So this one particular Uber driver was driving you, and you mentioned the Mario Lopez celebrity golf tournament that we played happened to be on Monday, May 13th. That's right. I'm listening to a podcast recorded on the 13th of May and my birthday, and I'm listening to it on the same day, the 13th. Well, it's August, but still, you see the synchronicity. Yes, I'm listening to a podcast on the 13th, recorded on the 13th, several months past. So thank you for this gift to my future self. I'm digging it, and I just hit something on the freeway. Hopefully I make it to the whiskey. We'll find out. My future self will be able to tell you. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for giving me a platform to share. Love you, brother.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Martin Schmidt. We have, in fact, interviewed him on a two-part or three-part. Was it two or three parts?
I don't remember.
I think it was
two.
Yeah, two parts. He's also known as the Soccer Monkey Extraordinaire, and he also has been restoring the Golden State Theater back to what its original face was. And so there are a lot of updates that I'm just very curious to share with you. And one of which, so Martin, you were saying that the pipe organ is now kind of messed up with all this rain?
Yeah, we had a rain leak through the roof and messed up the wind chests on one side. The organ is located in two chambers, one on either side of the proscenium. And that's what those big grills up there are for. The pipes are behind that. And the pipes themselves haven't been damaged much beyond a little surface rust. That can be cleaned up. But the problem is the wooden wind chests underneath them. Because when they get wet, the glue that holds them together starts to dissolve. And the leather valves start to deteriorate. And as soon as they get wet, that's you either have to rebuild it, or if it's really bad, you have to replace it. And so the two of the wind chests up there have to be replaced. And so right now the organ is not playable, which is a pity. But other than that, the old girl's been surviving pretty well.
Do you think that's one of the tricky things with an old theater, that maybe they didn't anticipate, you know, they didn't anticipate this kind of thing happening?
That's true. When they designed the place originally, the way they did it, which is common to a lot of commercial buildings, really, you got the two concrete walls, or four concrete walls, going up. And then instead of residential construction where the roof overlaps that, so that the roof will shed water off away from the building. In this case, it's got a very shallow pitched roof, but it ends inside the concrete wall. The concrete wall comes up a couple of feet beyond the edge of the roof.
So
common construction for commercial buildings. But the trouble, and you've got rain scuppers periodically along the sides, right, which are little holes in the concrete wall that the water is supposed to drain out through them rather than getting trapped on the roof. But in an environment like this, where we're so near the seaside, you get seagull carcasses up there, and you know their feathers shed every year, and they block up the roof drains, and then the water will pool up on the roof, and then it'll start finding its way. No matter how new and how good the roof is, if there's a pool of water on it, the water will find its way through. And that's exactly what happened.
Oh, boy.
So, it was a flaw. It was built into the building from when it was new in 1926. And it's catching up with us now. So I'd like to see more scuppers put in. That would help. You take a concrete drill and drill through the wall, or like a hole saw, and do that in more places down the walls. And that would help, but that's expensive.
I was just thinking, it'd be kind of, what popped in my brain was, it'd be interesting if there were like, kind of, you know, even if they put like just over the whole building like a slight, like a tarp of some sort.
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is still the roof comes down and ends inside the wall.
Oh,
that's the root. That's the Achilles heel.
Something that drips off the side or something.
That's what you'd have to do, would be to put a hip roof up on top of the whole thing. But even that's even more expensive. So, and plus it alters the look of the building from the outside. So then you got to run it through the architectural commission of the city, and et cetera, et cetera. It opens up a whole can of worms.
So now you created the miniature version that we talked about last time. Now you have it back at home.
I have it at home right now.
Working on some more stuff.
Because when I built it originally, which was just over 20 years ago now, I had planned. Oh, let me back up a little bit.
Yes,
in my study
yes.
of the building, which I've been crawling over for 15 years from attic to basement, and a lot of other spaces that weren't even intended for human habitation, I learned, and also I came across this in old literature. I learned that the facade of the building had an indirect lighting system at one time.
Oh.
There were floodlights behind the row of Spanish tiles on the top of the first floor that washed up on the second and third floors at night and created this beautiful glow.
Oh,
and then, of
cool.
course, they had floodlights on the original marquee, which would illuminate the center section. And then behind the little urns in the alcoves on the marquee, there were little accent lights that make the alcoves light up. The place was gorgeous at night.
Wow.
And I wanted people to be able to see that dimension of it as well. So when I built the model, I left accommodations to put in miniature lighting.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
And of course,
great.
This was over 20 years ago, and we didn't have all the LEDs and stuff we have today.
It's cool. It's like it was a gift to your future self.
It was.
And
yeah,
your future self
much.
Knew that at some point right. that would become
well,
available,
Well, my
right?
plan at the time was to use the technology that was available. The model builders... back in those days, used these tiny incandescent light bulbs they called grain of wheat bulbs because they're the size of a grain of wheat. And
oh, wow.
they still exist, but they're an incandescent bulb, so they get hot just like regular incandescent bulbs do. But that was the standard back in the day. But now we have these ultra micro LEDs and stuff. It's just wealth of resources. So I've been exploring what's available, and I think what I really want to do is buy myself a second 3D printer. I want to get an SLA printer, or now what I have is an FDM printer. That goes. Some of your listeners will know what that all means. But anyway, that would allow me to make in clear resin little miniature color caps for the marquee, for all the light bulbs that were on the marquee.
Oh, that's great.
Because I can't get an LED. You know, you got these little dome-shaped LEDs that you can get in all different sizes, but I can't get one that's quite the right size. The smallest I can get is 3 millimeters, and it really should be 2 millimeters. 3 millimeters is too big to fit where it needs to fit in the marquee.
Oh.
So I want to be able to make my own little color caps on a 3D printer. As I say, I have to use an SLA resin printer for that because the traditional 3D printers that melt filament and deposit it, they're not capable of fine enough detail to make really small objects.
Oh, wow.
So I want to make these little dome color caps that are 2 millimeters in diameter, and then they'll have a little square recess in the back for a side micro LED to glue in there, and then solder tiny wires. I'm going to have to wire the thing with a microscope.
Dude,
you know.
Incredible.
So
incredible.
It's going to be probably the better part of a year of work in my spare time because, I work full time. But I can see it in my mind. It's going to be stunning.
Yeah, it's like Tesla. You know, he would see it in his brain. He would work it out in his brain, and then... You know, there was no time for rehearsal. He already did the rehearsal in his brain.
Yeah.
So then,
zip,
when it comes out, it's already perfectly imagined,
exactly,
right?
Yeah. It's kind of, I'm not at his level, but that's the
idea.
It's
neat that
yeah.
you allowed for that possibility. Like knowing, okay, at some point, technology is going to catch up with my imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So hopefully that day will come pretty soon when I have the time to actually finish it. But, and of course, back then we had fiber optics.
Oh.
Which was going to be my plan for all the tiny little light bulbs. But that would have been this, forest of fiber optics leading to the marquee.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. So that was the best technology available at the time. But now we can leap over that and do something better. So looking forward to that.
Incredible.
When we were planning to meet here, I was kind of reminiscing about the tours that I used to lead when I was volunteering with United Artists, who owned the place at the time. This is going back into the 90s. And
you'd lead tours through here.
I used to, yeah.
No wonder why you knew all the nooks and crannies and all the secret places. That's cool.
Yep. And so I was, apropos of nothing, I was remembering the time that I gave a tour to a blind man.
Whoa.
Which may sound a little bizarre. Here's how it happened. His girlfriend is, if I remember correctly, this is like 20, 25 years ago. His girlfriend, I think, was a reporter for a local magazine or newspaper or something, and she was going to write an article, and she needed to gather material. And she brought him along. His name was Barry. I can't remember her name. And I think I had one of my other volunteers with me at the time. I can't remember who it was. And we were all sitting down in the front row, and we were all looking up the ceiling and discussing the architecture and all kinds of details about it. And I suddenly realized that poor Barry was being left out. because he couldn't see it. But I realized that it's all three-dimensional. And I said to Barry, hey, come here. I got something to show you. So I took his hand and I led him up onto the stage. And right next to the proscenium arch, you can see over there, see that urn right at the bottom?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just about the level of guy's head.
Yeah.
And it's in a little alcove, and there's this canopy over. It's all made of plaster. Oh. And I had him put his hand on that, and his face just lit up.
Wow.
Like you wouldn't believe.
Wow.
And it was this whole new dimension. So I tried to describe as best I could, you know, how it went up above his head and over the arch and everything, so he could kind of fill in with his imagination.
Incredible.
What he felt with his hands. And then I started realizing that if I took him around the theater, there was a lot of other stuff that was within reach. So I ended up taking him all over the place and allowing him to feel the bumpy plaster on the walls, which simulates an old medieval Spanish construction where they would take river stones and pile them up and put mortar in between.
Oh, my God.
It's all done in plaster.
I love
it. And the little balconettes on the side, those were within reach, and there was a shield in the lobby. And I took him over the whole place and just allowed him to feel everything.
Incredible.
And his girlfriend, I ran into her, I think, a week or two later on the street, and she told me he was talking about that for days.
I love that. So that is so cool.
So happy.
And that's so great, because had you not given him that experience, you'd never know what that experience was like, you know? And now you got the sugar plums dancing
right
in his head.
Yeah.
Wow,
so
man.
It's nice to make such a difference in someone's life.
Plus, there's such interesting chairs around here.
Mm-hmm.
And just like,
yeah,
you know,
well,
all along.
We didn't have all the ornamental chairs and stuff. This was back when United Artists still had the place.
Oh, gotcha.
It was just showing movies, and the old seats were still here. And they didn't have all the furniture in the lobby because United Artists couldn't afford it. But yeah, the plenty of ornamentation on the walls that he could feel, and it was just such a heartwarming experience. And it made me realize, you know, how magic these places are.
Mm-hmm.
And how magic they can be for someone who knows, you know, how to present them and how to present their history.
Oh, yeah.
And speaking of that, I'd like to take you around.
Let's do it.
And show you a few details that people might normally miss.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Let's go out and start in the lobby. Now, I'll give you a little bit of backstory here, a little bit of history. Back when this place opened, 1926, the previous, a lot of the previous theaters, especially in the big cities, they had fallen into kind of disrepute. Because there wasn't any quality control on the employees, the ushers could be surly. Of course, they didn't sell concessions in the theaters at that time, so you didn't have that to worry about. But the theaters weren't necessarily cleaned regularly and so on, and at least in certain cities. And people had this sort of distaste for them a lot of times, not all the time. And then that was all turned around in the 20s, teens and 20s, by a man named Samuel Rothafel, whose nickname was Roxy. A lot of people know the Roxy Theater in New York City.
Oh.
And he started small, operating Nickelodeon theaters, which is where you just took a storefront, hung curtains over the windows, put a hand crank movie projector in the back and a sheet on the other wall to project, and you get a piano in there and you'd show silent film, because that's all that
incredible
were. You didn't have silent films back then.
Just like a little room?
Yeah, it was just a converted room.
How many people do you think it would fit in there?
Oh, it depends on the size of the room. It varied widely, anywhere from 25.
It's like a very small theater of sorts.
Yeah.
That's
usually
cool.
They were converted storefronts. The price was typically a nickel. And the word Odeon is the Greek word for theater. So they started putting the two words together, and that's where the term Nickelodeon came from.
Awesome.
Okay,
oh,
was
that's
just these
good.
These little super low budget
that's good.
Theaters. And so they predated these movie palaces as, you know, in the teens, the really early days of silent film. But, you know, anyone could throw one together. Just buy a hand crank projector and get an old bed sheet to hang up for a screen and throw a few black curtains over the windows and rent a storefront for pennies, and you had a theater. Anyways, so Samuel Rothafel, Roxy, started in this business, and he realized that what the public didn't know they wanted was an extension of the movie experience into the theater itself, okay? And he realized the shortcomings of how existing theaters were being run. And so when he hired ushers, he had a very strict quality control. And he actually taught them military-style mannerisms And he would, in extreme cases, he would drill them in military formation in the lobby before the theater opened to get them in the right mindset to serve the public. And they wore white gloves and spiffy uniforms, and all the brass buttons were always polished, you know.
Wow.
And it was this, he did for movie palaces back then what Walt Disney later did for amusement parks when he opened Disneyland, because amusement parks were like Coney Island. There were these tacky, tawdry places with, you know, grime all over the ground, and these surly ride operators, and, you know, and you could take a date there and try to have a good time, but it wasn't really a really nice environment, and Walt Disney changed all that. Well, Roxy did that for the movie palaces in the
20s. Oh, cool.
So
he gave a whole new respect, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah, he really did. He elevated them far beyond what they were before in the public's mind. And so one of the things he did, and there's a whole reason why I'm getting to this, one of the things he did was that he realized, first of all, if you have a huge theater, I think the Roxy Theater had like 6,000 seats or something. It was enormous.
Wow.
And the Oakland Paramount in Oakland has 3,000 seats. This one only had half that. But still, you know, you had a show, you had all these people coming through the lobby, and you had to seat them all efficiently. They didn't have reserved seating like they do today. It was cash as cash can. And so the ushers needed to be able to direct the people efficiently. And, of course, you wanted to cram in as many shows as possible during the day, because that was how you made your money. So one of the things he taught the ushers was a system of hand signals that they could use to communicate to each other the locations of available seating as the theater was filling up, so they didn't have to yell over the patrons' heads.
Oh, that's cool.
They just hold their hand up and make a few hand signals, and the other usher would say, okay, you know, this section is full, you know, go to that section, whatever, whatever they were communicating. So they would do that, but that typically didn't work in the balcony because the ushers down here couldn't see the ushers that were stationed in the balcony.
Right?
No sight line directly. So they developed various signaling systems. The Oakland Paramount had a very extensive one. As I say, it had 3,000 seats. And the system is still, parts of it are still in place, although it's not used anymore, but it had this electromechanical relay system. And there's actually, there were these huge readout panels with rows and rows of light bulbs, and there was a telephone dial. You would dial in the number of the section and push a button, and the appropriate light would go on or off.
Incredible.
Very complicated system. This theater had a very simplistic version of that. Okay. There were two panels of switches in the balcony, and there were two readout panels, one on the mezzanine above our heads and one right over there in the lobby wall. And I don't know exactly what the system looked like, but I can show you where it was.
Cool.
You see that little spot where the plaster
is? Oh, that's great,
in?
Yeah.
Well, it's actually right here. That is how big the readout panel was. It had 10 light bulbs in it and two rows of five. And this was probably for the intercom because the place had intercoms.
Oh, that's cool.
As well. It was pretty high tech for 1926.
So someone who's upstairs, they could hear him, you know,
they
talking
could,
through here?
Right. Mm-hmm. And the usher, there'd be two ushers stationed up on the balcony, and they would flip the switches on and off that represented the different seating sections in the balcony.
Oh, that's
when
cool.
When one section was full, they'd reach down and flip off that particular switch, and the light down here would go out, and the usher that was stationed here, because this was an usher's station, and there would be another one on the other side, he would know that that section was full and to direct people up the other staircase or whatever. And then, of course, he could communicate that with a simple hand signal over his head to the usher who was standing at the foot of the other
cool.
staircase.
That's
so
cool.
It was very efficient. So, and I'll show you where the panel was in the mezzanine.
Oh, cool. Wow, man, there's so many. You could totally write a book just about theater, just about this theater alone.
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, there's so many sections, so many intricate things that you know about. Things that people wouldn't even know to ask about or think about or...
Yeah, because they don't know that those things existed. Here's where the other panel was, this little readout panel in the
cool. balcony.
There was a... I do have one photograph. It's not taken from straight on. It was taken from over there, so it's in a very oblique angle. But it does show this metal panel in the wall with a little earpiece for the intercomable cord hanging down.
By the way, you guys, we're standing upstairs on the second floor, just to the right, or stage left, if you will, of the bartending station. And there's a really cool light here. And just to the right of that is where the square is, in case you decide to come out here and check this out. Just up, diagonal and to the left, is what looks like a...
It's kind of a heraldic shield.
Yeah, heraldic shield.
All done in plaster.
But you'll see where the square is here.
Yeah, it's a little bit of plaster that's different from the rest. You can see we're a little square. It's about 10 inches on a side, I guess, and that's been filled in. And I actually have a piece that came out of that.
Oh, that's cool.
The manager at the time had saved it and just stuck it in a closet or somewhere, and then he eventually gave it to me. I don't know when that was removed, but he came across this piece and he knew what it was, and so he gave it to me. I had it at home. It's a wooden box with 10 little light sockets in it for a little tiny light bulb.
Yeah,
a little bit of wiring still in it. But
So if you were to restore this place, would you restore those
intercoms? I'd like to. Well, you know,
if
I had my druthers, if I could win the lottery, I would buy the place lock, stock, and barrel and go over it with a fine-tooth comb from top to bottom.
Wow, man.
Because that's what I've always wanted to do.
I just love how much of a relationship you have with this place. I mean, it really seems like there's a true collaboration here, you know? And the more that you learn about it, the more you want to learn and be educated about it, the more it reveals to you its surprises.
Mm-hmm. This place and I go way back. I was born about three blocks from here in 1958 at the old hospital across the street from the post office. I may have mentioned that in our last interview. And I grew up going to movies in this building. Back when it was still originally one auditorium. And then in 1976, I was 18 years old, and that's when they, for economic reasons, they had to close off the balcony and build two little movie theaters up there.
Mm.
That's when they put in the center staircase, because this didn't exist originally. This was just a big alcove. And I'm told there was one enormous sofa that filled it up from one end to the other.
It's like 15
feet
long. Used to be one big kind of circle in there.
Yeah. And the only entrances to the balcony were on the sides. And an important reason for that was that in the afternoon, the sunlight reflects off the sidewalk and through the entrance doors, right? And if you don't hang a curtain or something up above on the staircase, the light shines right up in the auditorium and you have no control over the lighting.
Interesting. Oh,
so, yeah, I'd love to take that out. I doubt that it'll be done. But as I say, somebody wants to help me win the lottery, it'll be a happy day.
All you spellcasters out there, I hope you're hearing this. Cast a spell so Martin can win the lottery and bring this back to what it originally was. Now, do you have pictures, a lot of pictures of, like, I assume you'd at this point from building the inside of it in a miniature fashion, of what the furniture might have looked like? Or, I mean, do you have a pretty good memory as to what you think
that
original stuff would look like?
What you see here now is what Warren Dewey bought when he had the place. He was the one who bought it from United Artists. Those four big regal-looking chairs at the end, he bought those. He bought this.
Really cool.
He bought these things. And they're pretty close to what the style was.
Oh,
would
that's
have
cool.
Been. So he did a good job there. And while we're on the subject of what they call the seat annunciator, that's what the name of the system was.
Oh.
Let's go into the balcony.
Yeah.
I got one little thing to show you on that.
Yeah.
On that topic. Oh, and Warren also put up these tapestries. Oh,
these are great.
Which here again are very much like what would have been here.
It's so fantastic that he goes with this theme all throughout.
Now this little alcove, you see all this decorative
in
the back? That was done by a friend of mine named Gary Parks. And what we did was we very, very carefully, layer by layer, scraped off the paint that had been applied later, got down to the remains of the original design, and he found out what it was and copied it.
Incredible.
So that's a reproduction of the original.
Wow.
Repeating design there.
It's so great that light is on in there.
Yeah.
Those textures are great. Oh, all the textures through here.
These doors weren't here originally. You can see where the frames bolted to the wall.
Oh.
These were added. But that was a long, long time ago. So here is where one of the ushers would have stood, and he had five little switches here and five little light bulbs.
Oh, cool.
And
so was he communicating with all of them or only the
just
people
the two
just straight down?
Panels,
gotcha.
They would look
gotcha.
At the lights and be able to see what was full and what wasn't. And over here is the other station. And this is the really fun part. Because the panel with switches is still there. This is the only part of the original system.
Cool.
So there's what it looks like.
Wow.
These little five toggle
switches.
Wow,
you guys. This is so cool. We're up here by the right, you know, if you go up the balcony.
House left.
We're over here by GG and RR, 1 through 19. We're all the way on the, house left.
And up above, you see these little holes?
Oh, yeah.
I actually took this panel off once years ago, and there are little pieces of glass in there that have been hand-lettered with India ink, the numbers 1 through 5.
Whoa.
And then 6 through 10 would have been on the opposite
side.
Whoa.
Incredible.
So that was a custom-built system.
Okay, so this right here is the representation of what you were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. That is the exact representation.
Yep, that's the only original piece left.
Oh, my gosh.
And while we're up
here,
notice the seating in the upper balcony.
Yeah.
And you see the end standards? They have a sort of design.
Yeah, they got a little
like
bell.
A mission bell
sort.
Tower.
Oh, yeah.
Well, these are not original to the theater. There is no original seating left, but they're as close as we come. This seating was manufactured in 1936 for the Carmel Theater in downtown Carmel, which was at the southeast corner of Ocean Avenue and Mission Street. and it's where Carmel Plaza is today. That theater was built in 1936, and it was torn down in 1959. Mm. And I don't remember it because I was only 1 year old at the time. So I've seen one photograph of the outside. I've seen no photographs of the inside. I have no idea what it looked like on the inside. But when they tore it down, of course, they didn't want to waste all this expensive fixtures that it had. So they sold them off to various other theaters, like the chandeliers would go to one place and the seats to another and so forth. And some of the seats came here and were installed here in 1959. So these seats are actually from the Carmel Theater.
Wow. It's just really cool, too, how they got, like, little roofs here.
Yeah, they got little Spanish tile roofs, and then you see a little alcove with a gold bell in it. And then right going right up to the top of the bell, you can see this little rope that's molded with a cast iron.
Oh, that's cool.
So all the details are right.
The details are phenomenal around here, everywhere you look.
And then those chandeliers that you see up above our heads
on
the balcony, those were missing from the theater for 28 years. When they divided this place in 1976, the economics of first-run movies made it necessary to have multiplexes. Mm. And so what they did it on a budget, fortunately for us, because it meant there was a lot left to restore later on, and this is one of the reasons they did it that way. They put two diverging walls in the balcony, starting at the projection booth. You can see on the ceiling the traces of these two walls where they were. They're diverging from each other as they leave the projection booth.
Oh.
And you can see where they make a right turn and a left turn respectively.
Yeah.
And so they seal off the balcony from the main auditorium. And
interesting.
They created two very cramped little movie theaters up here. And the same projection booth
would
serve all three theaters. They had three projectors up there. One would project through those ports into this theater. One would project through the tunnel into the main
Interesting. Yeah, so the people on the bottom had their own movies to watch. The people up here had their own. Was this just a big screen right here?
No. Yeah. Well, it was a screen on either side.
Each side had a screen.
There were two theaters up here with a blank tunnel between them.
Oh, man.
That's when that staircase was put in because they needed an extra emergency exit from the two theaters. Yeah, it's kind of hard to visualize now.
Crazy thing. Yeah.
But hang on a second. Let's see if my flashlight would work for you.
Dude.
There we go. So you can see that stripe there, a scar where the wall used to be. And then you see it turns right there.
Yeah,
and the wall continues there. So the screen was about here. But of course,
man,
it wasn't facing that direction. It was turned to face the projection booth.
Interesting.
So, and it was a very awkward experience because you see the seats here
are
facing the screen, the original screen on the side. But the new screen was off to one side. So you were sitting with your knees facing one direction and your head twisted to the side so you could watch the movie.
Interesting.
But it kept the place alive for 28 years. Because if they hadn't done that.
They had four separate quadrants here?
No, just three. They had two theaters with a tunnel between them to project the
film
that to
was
the main screen.
The downstairs.
Yeah, that was the downstairs. So
okay, gotcha.
One. So you had one big theater downstairs and two tiny ones up here.
Dude, it is crazy to visualize this.
But, you know, I'm glad they did it that way because in Merced, there's a theater there called the Merced Theater. It was designed by the same architects as this one. And it opened around the same time. I don't know if it was before or after. If you go to the Merced Theater, in the lobby, you'll see the lobby is a different shape, but you'll see all the same decorative motifs because they use the same decorator.
Do you know who it was?
Reed Brothers of San Francisco.
Oh, the Reed Brothers.
Reed Brothers. They got their start in Evansville, Indiana in 1878. From Evansville, they designed many buildings there, including the very first building they worked on was a library. It's called the Willard Library. It's still there to this day.
Mm.
And it's a museum dedicated to the life and work of the
Reed Brothers.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, which is really cool.
What? Have you been there?
No, I want to.
That sounds like a good field trip.
It would be.
And imagine, too, if they have any relatives that are still around, you know, you could pick their brains, too, on whatever they might remember.
I don't know if they do, yeah. That's a good question. Anyhow, from Indiana, they came out to the West Coast to San Diego because a resident of Evansville was a developer named Elisha Babcock, and he wanted to build a resort hotel in the San Diego area. So he liked their work, he commissioned them to do it.
Mm.
And so he brought them out to San Diego, and that hotel is still there to this day. It's called the Hotel Del Coronado.
They did that one?
Correct.
Oh, my God. I love how that's designed. I love how that feels in there, man. No wonder why. This is it. So they designed this. Del Coronado guys.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
And then from...
Wait, so is it true that if... Did you know about this? That
you probably know about this, that apparently Frank L. Baum wrote a lot of his The Wizard of Oz at the Del Coronado.
And oh,
apparently
I didn't
he
know that.
Designed the big chandelier that's up there, the crown. There's a crown chandelier.
I've never seen the inside of the building. I'm afraid I have to do one of these days. But
like inside of this one banquet room, mm-hmm. which is like a main room. Apparently he designed it.
That's
so
really
it's
cool.
Just crazy to like, if that's the truth, it's so crazy to like look up there and go, oh my God, Frank L. Baum. You know, he designed this. And the fact that he could have possibly written these other Wizard of Oz books at this magical place, it makes so much sense. That whole place just feels so magical.
Yep. That's interesting. I didn't know that. Anyhow, so from San Diego, they were commissioned by Klaus Spreckels, who was the patriarch of the Spreckels Sugar Company.
Mm.
They used to vacation down in San Diego, but they lived up in San Francisco. So Klaus Spreckels wanted the Reed brothers to design his residence in San Francisco. He was going to build a new house up there. So he brought them up to San Francisco. And then he designed the house not only for Klaus Spreckels, but for his son John. And then they started designing lots of other residences and commercial buildings in San Francisco. It was a lot of work to be had. And they just settled into San Francisco, and they spent the rest of their careers there.
Now, what do you suppose were some of the influences? The Reed brothers, right? The Reed brothers?
R-E-I-D.
The Reed brothers, I can't help but wonder, you know, because a lot of times the art that flows out of us is completely based on what
came into us.
Right. So I'm curious, like, with the Reed brothers, like, what kind of books they might have been reading growing up, what they were inspired by, because it'd be really interesting once you'd learn that information, to then see those parallel, those perspectives within the architecture
that
they're doing. Maybe there's a lot of King Arthur in there, you know, in there.
Could be.
You know, if they liked castle type things, you know, they might have been heavily.
Well, they did a lot of other types of motifs besides the Spanish castle one that we see here. But they did three theaters in this style. There's this one, the Merced Theater, and one in Oakland called the Fairfax, which is a church now.
Mm.
And it's interesting. I've been to both of those other theaters. Oh, I was going to mention that in the 70s, after this theater was triplexed, as I just described to you.
Mm-hmm.
We got an hour
on this, and I'll record the next
okay.
one.
But after they triplexed this house in 1976, they realized how awkward it was with the seating angles and things. And so when it came time to do the same thing to the Merced Theater, they totally gutted it.
No.
They scooped out every bit of ornamentation from the auditorium, and they built four theaters in there, just built new walls and everything, and it purpose-built.
Oh, my gosh.
And so the original ornamentation was completely lost.
Whoa.
But the manager that was there at the time hated to see that happen to the place. And before they demolitioned all of this stuff, he went around with his camera, and I don't know how many rolls of film it took him, because this is long before digital photography. He photographed the entire interior of the auditorium in some detail.
Incredible.
And he kept all the photographs for years. And a number of years ago, I don't remember how long ago it was, I think maybe 10 years ago, the city of Merced bought the place, and they wanted to restore it. And he, I don't know if he was still around, but his photographs survived.
Oh,
and
man.
From those photographs, they were able to reconstruct the entire auditorium from scratch.
What a dream.
I haven't seen it since it was restored. The time I was there was before it was restored.
Wow.
So I only saw the lobby and the modern auditoriums they had put in. But I'm told it's gorgeous. And it's more elaborate than this one. It actually has a blue sky overhead. And instead of relatively flat walls with lots of ornament and lots of little balconies like this place has, I'm told that it's actually more like a town. There are simulated buildings.
Oh, that's
on the
cool.
side, and it's not symmetrical. One side, as a typical town, is different from the other side.
Incredible.
This was
the
style.
And then
theater.
The sky, you're looking up at the sky. Once
and they can
again.
Project stars.
What a great motif that
like.
These guys roll with. You know, the fact that you're kind of outside, but you're inside.
Yeah. These were called atmospheric theaters because it was meant to look like you were in an outdoor auditorium when you were actually inside. Kind of predates Pirates of the Caribbean by decades, you know. And they were much more popular back east than they were out here.
Mm.
They constructed relatively few atmospheric theaters out here. The reason they were so popular back east was because of the harsh winters. People could come
what
in
a
the
grand
snow,
idea.
Out of the snow and ice and sleet. They'd take off their coats. They'd check them with the coat girl in the coat check place. And they'd go into the auditorium, and it would look like they were under the sky on a summer night.
Incredible.
So a nice bit of escapism. But you did find a few atmospheric theaters on the West Coast. This is one of them. And then they had the Merced Theater. And as I said, the Fairfax. Now, the interesting thing about the Fairfax, I mentioned the Merced Theater. The auditorium was quite different from this one, but the lobby was strikingly similar. Let's go back on the mezzanine.
Oh, yeah.
Oh yeah. In the Fairfax, so in the Merced Theater, the lobby is very similar to this one, although it's a different shape, but you can see all the stylistic elements are the same.
Yeah.
In the Fairfax Theater, it's the other way around. The lobby is quite different from this theater, but the auditorium is strikingly similar.
Interesting. Yeah. That is cool.
It is. You can see they're almost identical, not quite. There's a few little differences here and there. But, I've been to that theater many years ago. As I say, it's a church now run by really nice people, and they let us wander all over the place. They sort of showed us around for a while, and then the pastor had to go and take care of some church business. He said, hey, just wander around. He gave us free rein of the place.
That's great.
So he's such a nice guy. So
the Reed Brothers, you, in addition to theaters and people's houses, what else were they building?
Commercial buildings.
Oh, okay.
They did a lot of stores and office towers. They designed San Francisco's very first skyscraper.
Oh, wow.
At the time, there was a... Let's go in the office.
Yeah,
get away
from
the music here. At the time, there was a newspaper in San Francisco whose name was The Call, C-A-L-L. And the building that Reed Brothers designed up there.
Oh my God, there's so many secret... Oh wait, this is where you took me through before,
yeah,
right?
We were here.
Okay, that's right. Okay, no wonder why it looks so familiar.
There's a nice comfy sofa. So, yes, the San Francisco Call had its headquarters in what was known as the Call Building. That's why it was called that. And then, of course, eventually, I guess the Call went out of business. So the building is now called the Central Tower. It's still there, but it was given a facelift back in the 60s. So you wouldn't, if you were to look at old photographs and to look at the building today, you wouldn't recognize it.
Mm.
And even though it was the tallest building in San Francisco when it was built, which was just around the turn of the century, now, of course, it's dwarfed by all the buildings around it.
Mm.
But one of the things that I think Reed Brothers could be very proud of is that the San Francisco Call building survived the 1906 earthquake with almost no damage whatsoever. They used a very innovative, for the day, form of structural steel bracing inside.
Incredible.
And they had a little bit of cracking around the facade on the ground floor, and I've been reading newspaper accounts from the day, and that was all the damage there was to the building.
That's
and
incredible.
That was the tallest building, I think, west of the Mississippi at that time.
Wow.
So, yeah, they were very innovative. Their names were James and Merritt Reed. James was the older. Don't remember when they were born.
Do you think they planned? Like, in their brains, they're like, okay, there might possibly be an earthquake here. This has got to be able to withstand this. What can we do to kind of...
I don't know. Earthquake science wasn't as developed then as it is today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that probably wasn't much on their minds. But I think they were building for the ages, and they wanted to build as good quality a building as they possibly could, mm-hmm. especially since they were venturing into relatively unknown territory engineering-wise at the time, because people hadn't been building buildings that tall for very long.
Mm.
And so they might have over-engineered it a little bit to make sure that it would continue to stand for many years. So I think that was probably their philosophy on that. But
so when you see a building that they built, like, even if you're not told about it or you don't know about it, can you pretty much point it out and go, like, are there distinctive things that they tend to go in there and you're like, oh, yep, that's totally them?
Not necessarily, because they used different styles in different buildings. And of course, the style evolved over the years as different architectural fashions, different trends came and went. And so they would keep up with what the clients wanted. But very often, and so you can't necessarily recognize it, you can't necessarily look at a building and say, oh, that's Reed Brothers. But usually when you find out that a building is Reed Brothers, you can look at it and say, oh, okay, now I recognize this and this and this.
Oh, right, you know. Right. Because I'm curious if there is, like, because sometimes a lot of artists will have that sort of, like, signature thing that they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, when you look at a Frank Lloyd Wright house, you're like, whoa. You know,
yeah,
you kind of
exactly.
got a good vibe. Like, I bet you that's him.
There were other theater architects that you could say that of. I think Timothy Pfluger was a good example of that. You can certainly, now, of course, he I think, only designed movie palaces. But
which ones
usually,
did he do?
I believe he did the Oak and Paramount. He was a master of the Art Deco style, which came along in the late 20s and early 30s. Now, I would have to refer you to my good friend and colleague Gary Parks for more information on that, mm-hmm. because he's a walking library of all different kinds. I focus on this theater and the Reed Brothers. Mm-hmm. But he has this wide interest. He's seen theaters all over the country. He's a member of the Theater Historical Society, which I think is still around. And they used to have an annual conclave at different parts of the country every year, and he would go and travel to those, and they would tour. You know, one time they went to Detroit, another time they went to New York City, another time they went to Chicago, and so on. And they arranged tours of all these huge movie palaces. And so his interests are very broad, and he knows a great deal about the work of the various architects. Another name that pops to mind is Alexander Canton. He was a movie palace architect, and there were a few others. I don't know if I could rattle their names off the top of my head, but Gary certainly could.
Like, the people who are the architecture enthusiasts, especially with the invention of drones, I'm thinking that must be such a great feast for their eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're
able
to see up close
and, yeah,
what the, you know, way up there. They're able to see the faces and the carvings and everything like mm-hmm. that. Reminds me of kind of like these, there's this movie a long time ago called Station Agent, which is where Dinklage, you know, like one of the earliest movies, he did this indie film, and it was about like train enthusiasts, you know, and they would have these little clubs, and they just watch trains, old trains. They know all the numbers of the trains. They knew everything about mm-hmm. these trains. And I'm thinking, you know, for everything that exists out there, like this heater here, there's probably an entire society that, like, they know all about everything about the heaters,
sure.
right?
Antique kitchen appliances and things like that. Yeah,
and there are those people who are just so deep into it, right? Yep. And it's like they know the creators, they know the kind of plaster it was made with, they know all those kinds of things. So I'm just imagining what that, you know, how cool that would be.
Gary is kind of like that with movie palaces.
Oh, right.
So he can tell you, he can rattle off all the names and tell you who designed which theater and what styles they were designing, whether it was Rococo or Art Deco or Streamline Modern, which was a descendant of Art Deco in the late 30s, or Italian. Which there's a Reed Brothers theater in Oakland called the Grand Lake, which was done in the Italian style.
Mm.
So they did a lot of different styles. It's a whole world waiting to be uncovered.
Well, and that's
I should put you in touch with him if I haven't already.
Well, because I'm thinking, like, you know, because that's one thing to be able to, you know, be an enthusiast of like architecture and see up there, you know, the best you can and mm-hmm. whatever best photos that you can see that have already been taken in the past. But then in real time to be able to have a drone and go, that's interesting. There's symbolism hiding in here. You know, there's some esoteric meanings here. And whoa, what's that? You know,
well,
not
only is there necessarily symbolism in what the architect himself designed, which there often is, but often the workman who constructed it end up putting their own little details. Gary related the story, and I can't remember which theater this was, but he was exploring a theater on one of their conclaves. And he said he climbed up a ladder and peeked into a lighting alcove or something, which you wouldn't be able to see from the floor. And inside, hand-lettered in paint, was something that was obviously done by one of the decorators. And it said DERIT MI. And Gary scratched his head over that for quite some time until he realized that when you spell it backwards, it says, I'm tired.
That's brilliant. I'm tired. What a great little Easter egg, man. Yeah. What a great little thing that nobody would see. Nobody would see.
Nobody probably saw that for decades
until Gary
climbed up there.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah. And so this was sometimes done by the workmen. I don't know how often. Of course, there were a lot of these times it was hidden and you'd never find out, so you'd never know anybody.
I know, and plus, who knows what kind of secret passages are still hiding within these walls that nobody has discovered.
Well, not
yet,
a whole lot
know?
In this theater, but in some theaters there were. Some of the larger ones that were larger than this, they had a lot of elaborate architectural details and functions for different rooms. And yes, they would very often have not necessarily secret, but really semi-hidden corridors for the crew to go through or to sneak the star. Like, if, for example, if they were showing a silent film or a vaudeville show, of course, the program was mixed back then. And so you would have the stars come to the city in person and appear on the stage before a film, after the film, whatever. And so they needed to be able to, if it was a very popular star, they wouldn't want the star to be mobbed. So they would bring him down this, or her, down this back corridor, you know, which was semi-hidden from the rest of it.
The passage that nobody sees.
So, yeah, not so much in this theater because it was a small theater in a very small town. I don't remember if I told you at the last interview we did, but When this theater opened, as I mentioned, it had 1,600 seats. Monterey at that time was a city of 6,000 people.
Mm.
So basically, in four shows, this theater could seat the entire population of Monterey.
Dude!
It was phenomenal to have a theater that big in a town that small.
For the entire town to talk about the same stuff that's on the screen.
Well, one of the reasons it was built as large as it was because Monterey was a big tourist destination even then. But more so for the rich and famous, you know, than for the common man. A lot of people like to come out here. But travel was much more expensive and arduous back in those days.
Mm.
So the class of people that came here as tourists would have been a little different from what it is today. But it was still a big tourist destination. Across the street, you know where the Marriott Hotel is today?
Oh, yeah.
There was a hotel on that site before that, occupied the entire block. It was called the Hotel San Carlos. And construction started on that hotel at the same time as construction on this theater started, which was November of 1925.
Mm.
But that, of course, was a much larger, more complex structure, so it took a year longer to build than this theater did. So this theater opened in August 1926, and the Hotel San Carlos didn't open until 1927. But they were contemporaries, and it was a huge hotel. It occupied that entire block, just like the Marriott does. It was a different shape. There's one photograph of the outside that I... Well, there's probably several photographs of the outside in the old Pat Hathaway archives. Which we can't get to at the moment, but there is one photograph I know of hanging in a restaurant on Alvarado Street, and you can actually see what the hotel looked like. It was kind of Spanish in style.
Oh, that's cool.
As a lot of things around here were, because of the Spanish historical influence. A huge hotel here again in a tiny, tiny town, and because it was big tourism industry. And, of course, before the San Carlos was built, what is now the Naval Postgraduate School was the Hotel Del Monte.
Mm.
Okay, and that was built, I think, in the late 1880s or early 1890s, I want to say. I don't remember the exact year. Suffered a fire in the early 1900s, and then they rebuilt it. So it used to be Victorian when it was first built, and then they rebuilt it in more of a Mediterranean style. And today it was taken over by the Navy many, many, many years ago, and it's now the Naval Postgraduate School. They've built numerous buildings on the hotel grounds since then that have classrooms and labs and things, and they teach very high-tech stuff there, a lot of it classified. And so, unfortunately, the public doesn't get to go in and see the place anymore. But it was right on the train line from San Francisco. The train tracks were right across the street, and there was a little depot there, a little raised platform, a little roof over it. Nothing elaborate, but it was a special stop just for the hotel, and you could get off at that stop, and then they would have horse-drawn carriages to take you across the street and through the hotel grounds up to the entrance.
Interesting.
To the hotel.
I'm getting sensations here of thinking, like, I wonder if that's how whoever commissioned the Reed brothers to make that building in San Francisco, maybe if that train track, this is just a theory that popped in my brain, maybe they had come out, they went to the theater, they're like, this is a phenomenal theater. You know, and they had taken that train from San Francisco. They come out, they see the theater, they're like, hey, I want you to do the same thing for me in San Francisco. You know, awesome. And then the Reed brothers, they hop on a train, and zip, off they go.
Yep. Yeah.
It'd be interesting if that train line, now that I'm talking about this, maybe, I'm wondering if maybe along that train line, if where we will find a lot of Reed brothers, you know, in those specific towns. That'd
it's
be kind
question.
Of interesting.
Yeah. I hadn't really
Reed Brothers
about that.
Buildings.
Of course, it wouldn't have been this particular train line because this was a spur line that ended in Pacific Grove.
Oh, okay.
And then it went up to San Francisco and then connected the one with the main line that would have gone between like Oregon and Los Angeles or Washington and Los Angeles. So there's a Amtrak runs a line up and down the West Coast today called the Coast Starlight, and it takes that route. It goes down the Salinas Valley, and I took it once many, many years ago. In the late 70s, it was gorgeous trail. We started in Salinas actually, where the train stopped.
So, did you ever want to be an architect?
No, I love architecture, but it wasn't something I ever really thought about being. Good question. Nobody's ever asked me that before.
Yeah, because I'm wondering, you from your deep investigations, your deep dives on this stuff, I can only imagine that you would start to begin to have your own ideas as to what it might be like if you were to make your own ideal theater.
I didn't do theaters, but I used to draw cars and buildings and things like that, and I always liked the space age, you know, so I'd draw futuristic looking buildings and so forth. But that was as far as it ever went. So I was going to tell you a story before the musicians or the sound check interrupted us there.
Hold on. Before you get in the story, we're at 48 minutes. Yeah. So, yeah, we'll start the next. Okay. So the next episode, you will hear the story that Martin Schmidt will be talking about. It's astounding how fast time flies, right, when you're having fun. Thank you for listening to Inspirato Projecto. Tune in for part two with Martin Schmidt. Thank you once again, Martin Schmidt, for coming by and hanging out at the Golden State Theater, teaching us your knowledge of what you know about it and its history, the intricacies of its architecture. It's just very exciting. Stay tuned if you're listening to this. If you liked this episode with Martin, please stay tuned to Inspirato Projecto podcast. You will find us on Spotify, iTunes, iHeart, all the podcasting apps that exist. You will find Inspirato Projecto. So keep your eyes peeled, keep your ears peeled, and you will hear part two sooner than later. By the way, also, thank you, Blythe Baines, for closing out the show and for saying hello. Take care, everyone.
This is Blythe Baines, and you're listening to Inspirato Projecto.